print disability, which makes reading, holding a book, or turning a page difficult or impossible. The content is copyrighted by the respective publishers. For more information, please visit us on the web at nfradioreading.org.
Hello, this is Corrine, and for the next hour, I'll be reading from the August 27th, 2026 issue of the Wall Street Journal on the Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service. As always, thank you for joining us today. The highlights under business and finance are: Meta Platforms agreed to an $18 billion settlement with 48 state attorneys general, bringing an end to a massive federal trial over social media's harm to teenagers. NVIDIA reported record sales of $96.2 billion, lifting its shares higher in after-hours trading, as a forecast of accelerating growth helped calm rising anxiety about the viability of the AI trade. Major U.S. stock indexes slipped, leaving the S&P 500 little changed, and the Dow and NASDAQ down 0.2% and 0.1% respectively. Google moved a team focused on the risks and societal impact of artificial intelligence out of Google DeepMind, the research lab developing its frontier AI models. Vanguard Group struck a deal to acquire fintech platform Altruist for about $4 billion to advance its push into financial advice. A cyber attack at medical device maker Boston Scientific triggered a global outage of key operational technology, leaving the company unable to fill orders. Ben and Jerry's is poised to name three new independent directors to anchor the restructuring of its board, following a long search for suitable candidates. Siemens Energy said it is preparing to spin off its transformation of industry division and is exploring potential ownership structures. Abercrombie and Fitch's second quarter sales climbed 4.8% to $1.27 billion, exceeding Wall Street's expectations for $1.25 billion. Now for the key articles under the Worldwide section. The FDA approved a Revolution Medicines drug that, in a late-stage trial, helped pancreatic cancer patients live nearly twice as long as those on chemotherapy alone. The air war between Russia and Ukraine entered a new phase as expanded aerial arsenals met inadequate air defenses, resulting in a rising civilian toll. CIA Director John Radcliffe's surprise visit to Moscow this week was to deliver a warning to Russia not to attack NATO countries. U.S. officials said they disrupted a China-linked hacking operation that broke into U.S. government networks and critical infrastructure while going to great lengths to hide its tracks. A lawyer for Fed Governor Lisa Cook told the White House that its allegations she committed mortgage fraud are unfounded, a response to the Trump administration's new threat to fire her. The Trump administration paused the processing of immigrant visas to train visa officers on new guidance on applicants' financial self-sufficiency. Florida Governor Ron DeSantis said the use of automated license plate readers is out of control as debates continue across the U.S. over Flock Safety's AI-enabled cameras. An inquest was opened into the death of Jason Arday, a Cambridge University professor who faced a storm of plagiarism accusations. Vietnam's trade surplus with the U.S. in the first half reached $114 billion, bigger than any other country's. Passenger traffic at Dubai International Airport fell 30% in the second quarter from the first, as the Iran war disrupted Gulf aviation, though volumes recovered as airlines gradually restored capacity. Died Tim Curry, 80, Rocky Horror villain. The picture on today's front page is a composite of three identical pictures, except in the first it shows a massive government center, in the second a small wave of water, and in the third a complete gusher of water taking over the government center. And that headline reads, Engulfed. A flash flood crashes into the Geerung Port building on the Nepal-China border in video footage Wednesday. At least 157 were killed and hundreds were missing in the region. The main headline, Lethal Walls of Water Hit Himalayas. The article, at least 157 die as flash floods devastate Nepal. Hundreds of people are missing, including nearly 50 U.S. citizens traveling in area. By Tripti Lahiri and Krishna Pokharel. As the roar grew louder, people at the customs checkpoint that sits at 6,000 feet on the border between China and Nepal started running. In seconds, video shows a monstrous wave surged over and around the Geerung Port building, burying everything in mud. Hundreds of people are missing in Nepal and China after devastating floods likely triggered an avalanche high in the Himalayas, washed through towns and villages popular with Hindu and Buddhist pilgrims. At least 157 people are dead in Nepal, according to officials, a figure that will certainly rise. Dozens of foreign tourists, including nearly 50 Americans and more than 130 travelers from India, are unaccounted for. Scientists around the world who research mountains, ice, and the river systems downstream are trying to determine what caused such a destructive flood. For now, scientists say the leading hypothesis they are examining, based on initial satellite data comparisons, is that a large piece of a glacier broke off and tumbled hundreds of feet into the valley below, where the ice was pulverized into water by the sheer velocity of the fall and met up with downstream rivers. Other articles from the front page follow. Meta settles child safety suit, company to pay up to $18 billion and safeguard its apps for underage users, by Megan Brabowski. Meta Platforms agreed to an $18 billion settlement with 48 state attorneys general, bringing an end to a massive federal trial over social media's harm to teenagers and ushering in a new era of tech companies having legal responsibility for their platforms. Under the settlement, Meta also agreed to make sweeping changes to its services, Facebook and Instagram, including implementing a default 2-hour time limit on its apps for users under 18. In a unique setup, Meta will pay out only 70% of the settlement unless TikTok and YouTube, which is owned by Alphabet, also agree to set default 1-hour time limits a day on their apps for underage users and each pay the states about $5.3 billion. Meta will only pay the remaining 30% of its settlement, also $5.3 billion, if the two other companies agree to the terms. The settlement will be distributed to the signing states in annual installments over a 10-year period based on their populations. It includes 48 states and 4 U.S. jurisdictions: the District of Columbia, Puerto Rico, American Samoa, and Northern Mariana Islands. New Mexico, which sued Meta in a similar trial this spring and won, and Florida aren't now part of the settlement. Other agreed platform changes include launching night mode, a default block on its apps between midnight and 6 a.m., and a school mode, disabling push notifications during school hours of 8 a.m. to 3 p.m. for underage users. The settings can only be changed with a parent's permission. In a statement, Florida Attorney General James Utmeyer, a Republican, said the state didn't join the settlement because the payouts are peanuts compared to the profound harms Meta's profit-driven, addictive features inflicted on kids. He said he looks forward to seeing Meta at trial. FDA clears drug for pancreatic cancer by Xavier Martinez. For 4 decades, cancer researchers fought to disable a stubborn mutation that made pancreatic cancer a death sentence, to little avail. Now doctors have a medicine that targets the mutation. The Food and Drug Administration's approval of the drug from Revolution Medicines on Wednesday marks a milestone in the treatment of one of the most intractable kinds of tumors. "This is life-altering," said Carla Kurgian, an oncologist at Mercy Hospital in Oklahoma City who wasn't involved in the studies. "Not just for patients, as far as helping them extend their lives beyond anything we've ever seen, but for us as physicians to be able to have a different conversation than we've had for so long." The drug, called Rozin-Q, helped subjects in a late-stage study live more than 13 months, nearly twice as long as those on chemotherapy alone. When presented at the world's largest gathering of cancer researchers last spring, the results drew a nearly minute-long standing ovation. The drug does have side effects, including a harsh rash across the body and gastrointestinal issues. Former Senator Ben Sasse of Nebraska, who went public in the spring with what he described as a significant reduction in his tumors while in a clinical trial of the drug, appeared on television with his face covered in red blotches. RevMed said the drug will cost $39,800 a month, or more than $477,000 a year. The company's stock closed up nearly 2% Wednesday in NASDAQ trading. Wall Street expects Razanek, which was approved for use in patients for whom other treatments failed, to be a big seller. The drug could generate more than $20 billion in annual sales, according to pharmaceutical commercial intelligence firm Evaluate, if the drug proves to work safely in earlier stages of the disease and with different types of cancer. You are listening to a reading of articles and features from the Wall Street Journal on the Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service. NVIDIA forecasts 70% rise in revenue in 2028 by Robbie Wayland. NVIDIA reported record sales of $96.2 billion on Wednesday, sending its shares higher in after-hours trading, as a forecast of accelerating growth helped calm rising anxiety throughout the market surrounding the viability of the artificial intelligence trade and fears about overspending on AI infrastructure. For the quarter ended in July, NVIDIA reported a 4% rise in sales, which were higher than the $92.3 billion analysts polled by FactSet had expected. Net income of $59.7 billion and earnings per share of $2.46 also beat analyst expectations by wide margins. The crucial data center segment, which includes most of AI servers for which NVIDIA is best known, produced sales of $89 billion. Analysts had expected $86.3 billion in sales. NVIDIA's shares gained more than 4% in after-hours trading after Chief Financial Officer Colette Kress, speaking on a conference call with investors and analysts, said the company expects revenue to grow 70% in 2028. The fall of the Nostradamus of AI. A 24-year-old investor attracted billions to his fund before turning cautionary tale. By Berber Jin, Ben Cohen, and Anissa Gardizzi. For the past few years, at happy hours and dinner parties in San Francisco, Leopold Aschenbrenner kept confusing people by sharing his favorite outlandish idea. He wanted to buy galaxies. Some of his friends weren't always sure what to make of Aschenbrenner's intergalactic ambitions. He once left the room and they debated whether he was referring to physical galaxies or a type of private plane. No, he assured them when he came back, he meant galaxies. His idea was that advances in artificial intelligence would soon unlock resources on a cosmic scale, enabling humans to colonize faraway planets. He planned to save money now so he could spend on galaxies, he told them, and make his mark across the universe. To almost everyone in this world, outside the AI bubble of Silicon Valley, the idea of scooping up property rights outside of Earth might sound improbable. But in Aschenbrenner's world, that sort of fervent belief was among the reasons the 24-year-old investor was hailed as a visionary. Since graduating from Columbia University in 2021 as the class valedictorian at age 19, he has worked his way into the upper echelons of technology. He spent time working out of now convicted crypto founder Sam Bankman-Fried's compound in the Bahamas, and then at OpenAI in San Francisco, even as he drew attention as a troublemaker among some of his bosses. According to people who worked with him, he grew close to the industry's top players. 2 years ago, he made bold predictions about the impending arrival of superintelligence in a 165-page manifesto called Situational Awareness. He quickly turned that interest into money for a hedge fund that eventually managed $45 billion in assets. He was barely of drinking age and had no prior investing experience, but his cozy relationships inside the industry fed into his reputation as an oracle of AI. He mixed the personal and professional in a city where the two are rarely kept apart. There are perhaps a few hundred people, most of them in San Francisco and the AI labs, that have situational awareness, he wrote in his viral essay. Through whatever peculiar forces of fate, I have found myself amongst them. When Ashenbrenner's hedge fund unraveled last month, veterans on Wall Street saw it as the latest cautionary tale of hubris, another inexperienced, overconfident investor taking on too much risk with far too much leverage. Securities regulators are also investigating the trading activity of his fund, Situational Awareness, though they haven't made any formal allegations of wrongdoing. Russia-Ukraine war enters deadlier phase. Pain plus exhaustion produces political capitulation. By Marcus Walker. A Russian barrage of missiles and drones hit a children's hospital, a school, apartments, and warehouses around Kyiv last week, killing at least 16 people. Ukraine, lacking Patriot interceptors, didn't shoot down any of Russia's ballistic missiles. Ukraine's response this week included a drone strike that caused a fire at one of Russia's largest oil refineries near Nizhny Novgorod on Wednesday. Meanwhile, in the central Russian region of Tambov, a warehouse belonging to e-commerce brand Wildberries burned. The air war between Russia and Ukraine has entered a new phase. With expanded aerial arsenals and inadequate air defenses, both sides are bludgeoning each other in a fight that is causing a widening swath of destruction and a rising civilian toll. Moscow is betting it can crush the will of Ukraine's civilian population, giving it the breakthrough that has eluded its army in eastern Ukraine. Kyiv is trying to make Russia's invasion unsustainable by crippling the industries that underpin its economy. Yet neither side appears to be close to breaking. The war is getting more ruthless and destructive, but no closer to ending. Xpeng bets robots will be big moneymaker. By Zhaouet Wang. Xpeng carved out a space in China's car market with autonomous driving, but it's robots, not vehicles, that could become the company's biggest moneymaker. Though the U.S.-listed company's robotics unit has yet to generate meaningful revenue, Xpeng company president Brian Gu thinks its margins will eventually eclipse those of the core electric vehicle business. Valued at more than $6.3 billion, the unit will start mass-producing XPeng's humanoid robot this year. Iron, a realistic-looking robot with electronic skin and a bionic spine, could deliver a hardware gross margin of more than 50%, said Gu, who is also vice chairman of the Guangzhou-based company. That compares with the 12.1% gross margin XPeng's vehicle segment recorded in the second quarter. China dominates the global supply of humanoid robots, and analysts expect momentum to keep growing as Beijing throws its weight behind the sector and technological breakthroughs continue. But there are reservations about the monetization in the capital-intensive industry. Building a robot capable of handling multiple tasks like staffing an information desk or making coffee requires significant training and computing power that will probably cost more than developing a vehicle, Gu said. Banks' resistance to stablecoins eases. Traditional firms, long on the defensive, consider moving into burgeoning market. By Gina Hebe and Vicky G. Wan. Banks large and small have started to warm to the idea of their own stablecoins, despite early doubts from some executives that there will be much demand for them. Some bank executives over the past year had shrugged off the need for stablecoins, and the industry waged a lobbying battle against crypto firms that wanted to offer stablecoins that would act like bank deposits. Instead, banks banded together to launch a tokenized deposit system as an answer to the rapid changes in the world of payments. Stablecoins are digital tokens pegged to the U.S. dollar or other currencies, while tokenized deposits are just traditional money represented as digital tokens. But now a number of banks have started to consider whether there could be a need for both, even if only as a defensive play, as some executives worry stablecoins could encroach on their businesses. Big non-bank companies such as Visa, BlackRock, Google, and DoorDash have moved to get involved in the stablecoin market, which has been dominated by Tether and Circle. In essay warning about AI, Gates worries there is no plan, by Lindsay Ellis. Billionaire philanthropist Bill Gates issued a stark warning about artificial intelligence risks to employment and the human condition, saying companies are barreling ahead with the technology with no larger plan for the upheaval it would cause. Even under the best circumstances, the transition to this new AI era will be one of the most turbulent times in human history, he wrote in a 12-page essay published to his personal website on Wednesday. Right now, we are preparing for it. I don't see evidence that leaders, experts, and communities are confronting the challenges adequately. The message is more sober than Gates' 2023 essay on AI, when he wrote he was as excited about this revolution as the internet and personal computer rollouts. Though Wednesday's missive highlighted AI's potential for good, citing developments in energy, medical care, and agriculture, he stressed how badly things could go wrong if the transition is mismanaged. There is no plan to ease the entry into the AI era, Gates wrote, calling for more regulation of the technology. A representative for Gates Ventures said the Microsoft co-founder decided to weigh in now because he believes there is little time to prepare for the transition. In his essay, Gates said he would talk to lawmakers about this in Washington. You have a chance to act now before unemployment rises sharply. You are listening to a reading of articles and features from the Wall Street Journal on the Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service. From the editorial page, Alaska voters seeing double Dan Sullivan. The state's top four ranked choice system delivers another fiasco. Dan Sullivan endorses Dan Sullivan to beat Dan Sullivan, an NBC headline explained recently. That about captures this year's ranked choice voting circus in Alaska as the state continues tabulating results for its August 18th primary. The top four candidates in the Senate race, eligible to appear on the fall ballot, include two Dan Sullivans, meaning control of Congress could turn on voter confusion. Not so funny now, is it? The latest numbers, with about 6% of ballots outstanding, show Democrat Mary Peltola with the most primary votes, about 76,100. Then comes incumbent Republican Senator Dan S. Sullivan with 65,500. Primary turnout doesn't necessarily predict November, but this election could be close. If it is, the difference between a Republican hold and a Democratic flip could depend on the candidates listed on the ballot in the third and fourth slots. Analysts couldn't call it last week since not enough of the primary vote was counted. But now it is, and the number three winner with 3,800 ballots is Dan J. Sullivan Jr., or Decoy Dan, as some call him. Mr. Sullivan keeps insisting his candidacy isn't meant to confuse voters. He's simply a moderate Republican who says he has voted twice for Ms. Peltola and never for Senator Sullivan. How strange or not that he polled best in Democratic areas, including parts near Anchorage, where he took 4% of the vote. The race for number four is still open, with David Leslie, a Democrat, at 1,710 votes, trailed closely by Gerald Hikas, a Republican, with 1,667. Since the November ballot is ranked choice, voters can choose multiple candidates, yet some inevitably pick a single name. The other swirling possibility is that a minor candidate could drop out as a way to help Ms. Peltola or Senator Sullivan. If that happens, number five is promoted to the ballot instead. This is the absurd game the two parties are now playing in Alaska. Millions of dollars were spent in the primary to prop up also-ran candidacies and affect the composition of the November ballot. Mr. Leslie told the Anchorage newspaper that people had messaged him to compliment his ad. I was like, what are you talking about? I have no video ads. Also getting mystery promotion was a Green Party contender who doesn't live in Alaska, who says he filed his candidacy for fun. This surely isn't what Alaskans had in mind 6 years ago when they narrowly adopted this top four primary system and ranked choice voting, 50.6% to 49.5%. In 2024, a referendum to repeal it failed, 49.9% to 50.1%. Voters will have another opportunity in November via ballot measure 2. Are more Alaskans now ready to give this system the heave-ho? By the way, the third name doppelganger in that NBC headline is former Anchorage Mayor Dan A. Sullivan, a Republican, who's the oldest of the trio. As the OG Dan Sullivan, he wrote, claiming the title of original gangster. I urge Alaskans to vote for Senator Dan S. Sullivan. He's been great for Alaska. From the opinion pages, J.D. Vance is the GOP's Obama. He and the former president have much in common, and both disdain Republicans. By Barton Swaim. Now in 1984, just to date myself a little bit, don't hate me, 1 month before I was born, the Wall Street Journal, the voice of big business in the United States of America, proposed, and I quote, a five-word constitutional amendment. There shall be open borders. So remarked Vice President J.D. Vance last week in his hometown, Middletown, Ohio. Now, they weren't joking. They were being tongue-in-cheek, he continued, because if you look at what they tried to do over the next 40 years, they told you back then exactly what they were trying to do. What he thinks they were trying to do, as you can probably guess, was replace American workers with low-wage foreigners. You would think that the proposal of a five-word constitutional amendment would recommend itself as a bit of a provocation. But Mr. Vance, whose strengths don't include a sense of humor, plainly doesn't care about the argument advanced by that 1984 editorial, which concerned Cold War-era immigration policy. Anyway, he, or the aide feeding him hooey about the journal as the voice of big business, wouldn't know or care that among the newspaper's most famous editorials is one from 1979 headlined, Down with Big Business. The curious may wish to consult an update. Down with Big Business Again, published in 2021. Mr. Vance's propensity to caricature arguments with which he disagrees puts me in mind of Barack Obama. In his first address to Congress in 2009, the 44th president said, I reject the view that says our problems will simply take care of themselves. That says government has no role in laying the foundation for our common prosperity. Over the next 8 years, Mr. Obama constantly rejected beliefs nobody held. I reject the idea that we need to ask people to choose between their jobs and their safety, he said in 2011. Ideological differences aside, the personas and careers of Messrs. Vance and Obama bear weird similarities. Both had tough upbringings marked by an absent father, intermittently absent mother, and reliable grandparents. Both took an improbable journey, largely on the strength of smarts and industry, from broken home to the Ivy League, Mr. Obama to Columbia, and after a stint as a community organizer, to Harvard Law, Mr. Vance to Yale Law. Neither spent much time practicing law. Mr. Obama soon moved on to academia, Mr. Vance to venture capital. Both wrote a powerful rags-to-riches memoir, Dreams from My Father, Hillbilly Elegy, and followed it with a pretentious straw man-laden campaign book, The Audacity of Hope, Communion. Both served briefly in the U.S. Senate before catapulting to executive power, though Mr. Vance has yet to shed the vice in his job title. I would have thought it all the stuff of parlor game happenstance, but events of this summer tempt me to regard the two men as expressions of a type. I refer, of course, to Mr. Vance's conviction that he, by the force of his personality, could turn Iran's bloodthirsty, mendacious revolutionaries into practical men, ready to negotiate in good faith. In June, pursuing what became the short-lived Memorandum of Understanding, the Vice President repeatedly described his and his colleagues' efforts to bring reason to the U.S.-Iran relationship as though the idea were original. For 47 years, this country has been a thorn in our side, Mr. Vance said to Jake Tapper in June. The coolest thing about the progress we've made over the last few weeks is that you see people within the Iranian system, senior leadership, even IRGC officials say, you know what? We may have some animosity, we may have some mistrust, but we recognize the way we've done business with the United States for the last 47 years is a mistake. Let's try something else. It's true that President Trump has said similar things, though only a fool would take those statements as sincere. Mr. Vance spoke his lines with conviction. Mr. Vance likes to tout his youth. Don't hate me. But he was old enough to follow the news in the 2010s as Mr. Obama attempted to turn U.S. policy away from Israel and draw Iran into the community of peaceable nations. Mr. Obama, too, liked to contrast his practical an interest-based approach to that of his ideology-driven predecessors. With few exceptions, though, Mr. Obama limited his scoldings to members and administrations of the other party. At the core of Mr. Vance's message is the repudiation of views allegedly held by both parties, especially his own. In Brewer, Maine, this week, the Vice President described that bipartisan consensus again, though the caricature has a conspicuously Republican shape to it. What places like Brewer really needed, they told us, no prizes for guessing who they were, was just to juice the short-term profits of a few big corporations, that we needed to open that border and prioritize foreign workers over our own citizens. They would cheer on the corporate raiders as they slashed headcount and shifted all those businesses either to foreign countries or brought in illegal aliens to employ. Leave the policy argument, if you can call it that, to one side. The lines reveal a man so contemptuous of views different from his own that he can't be bothered to understand them. Now ponder a future GOP headed by such a person. Mr. Obama at least respected the party he led. You are listening to a reading of articles and features from the Wall Street Journal on the Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service. Nix on Nixon, How to Defeat the DSA. Republicans should press their opponents to endorse or disavow socialist proposals. By Carl Rove. The rise of the Democratic Socialist of America is a political gift for Republicans. If GOP House candidates want to take advantage of it, here's a version of a simple speech to consider. I've written it for a candidate in Florida, where State Representative Angie Nixon, a DSA member, is the Democratic U.S. Senate nominee. It forces Democrats into an uncomfortable choice. Side with DSA's extreme views or break with the group and upset its energized and increasingly influential supporters. The speech would go something like this. Florida voters face a big question in the midterm election. How do you feel about a statewide ticket led by a member of the Democratic Socialist of America? It should scare the hell out of you, because the DSA's agenda is more radically leftist than any we've seen in our lifetime, and the DSA is increasing its influence in the Democratic Party. How bad could it be? Let's start with this. The DSA platform wants an America where you don't pay a mortgage or have a landlord. Sounds nice until you get to the details. In DSA world, government will build new publicly owned social housing. Some will remember those big, ugly apartment blocks in the Soviet Union. That's DSA leaders' vision, whether they admit it or not. Unless they say otherwise, you should assume Angie Nixon and my Democratic opponent support it. The DSA agenda says government must treat food, education, energy, medicine, and transportation as common goods and utilities, and that democracy requires public ownership of the largest corporations and essential industries. Again, you should assume Ms. Nixon and my Democrat opponent are on board with the DSA unless they deny it. Here are some questions. Since food would be a common good, would farmers work for the government? What about large Florida companies? Will government take over your local public store? The home builder, Lenner? How about Ryder Trucks and CSX Railroad? Miami is headquarters for the Carnival, Norwegian, and Royal Caribbean cruise lines. Does Ms. Nixon want government to take them over? Does my opponent? If they won't say no, assume they do. Let me get really serious. Do we want federal bureaucrats to be in charge of Mickey Mouse and Disney World? The DSA blames America's problems on private ownership and profit. It claims our free enterprise system is making us desperate and miserable. Unless they say otherwise, you should assume Ms. Nixon and my Democratic opponent agree with those sentiments. I promise you, I don't. The free enterprise system has shortcomings. That's why I'm a reform conservative. But our free enterprise system made America the most prosperous, creative, open, and compassionate country in the world. It's why the people want to come here. There are many more things the DSA demands that Floridians should be concerned about. A 32-hour work week, but with a 40-hour paycheck. What small business could cope with that? Phase out the use of fossil fuels. fully abolishing the police and prison systems. Abolish ICE and legalize migration. That is open borders. The DSA would defund the Department of War and close overseas military bases. The DSA was silent at best following Hamas's October 7th attack and obsessively accuses Israel of genocide. The DSA platform calls for letting immigrants vote before they naturalize, making the District of Columbia a state, abolishing the Senate and Electoral College, having taxpayer dollars fund campaigns, and having congressmen elect the president and the Supreme Court. I'll ask again, do Angie Nixon and my opponent in this House race agree with the DSA program? If not, say so, emphatically and forcefully, loud enough so that DSA supporters hear. But if Ms. Nixon and my opponent refuse to disavow DSA's agenda or remain silent, then we Republicans should attack and attack again. Make them squirm as voters turn against them. Parents, know your rights as school begins. Recent Supreme Court rulings reinforce your authority to direct your children's education. By Ian Pryor. If you have school-aged children, you may be worrying about what your kids will be exposed to when class resumes. Will teachers ask them for preferred pronouns rather than teach them standard English? If your son is confused about his sex, will the school encourage him in the belief that he is a girl and conceal it from you? Will your daughters be forced to share a locker room with boys? More generally, will the school propagandize your children about controversial social topics without your knowledge or consent? These are real dangers that are the subject of school board battles, federal investigations, and lawsuits across the country as parents increasingly challenge policies that infringe on their authority and they believe harm their children. The good news is that parents are no longer powerless. Recent Supreme Court decisions, combined with an administration committed to enforcing federal law, have significantly strengthened parental rights. Here's what you need to know as your children go back to school. You have the right to opt out. In Mahmoud versus Taylor, 2025, the justices held that the Montgomery County, Maryland public schools had violated parents' First Amendment rights by refusing to provide notice and opportunity to opt out of instruction involving LGBTQ plus inclusive storybooks for parents who objected on religious grounds. This March in Mirabelli versus Bonta, the court issued an unsigned order that further reinforced those protections. The justices said that a school's facilitation of a child's gender transition without parental consent likely violates the parents' right to direct their children's upbringing and education. Taken together, these decisions make clear that school districts must provide parents the ability to opt their children out of sex-related policies the parents find objectionable. America First Legal has made available an opt-out template letter for parents to personalize and send to their children's school, demanding that schools comply with a request on these issues. Courts will treat failure to comply with these requests as an unconstitutional deprivation of a parent's constitutional rights. The Family Educational Rights and Privacy Act gives parents the right to their children's records. FERPA, which Congress enacted in 1974, provides parents the right to inspect records, files, documents, and other materials which contain information directly related to their children. This extremely broad definition may include records related to gender identity, including the use of different names or pronouns that don't match the child's sex. Schools that fail to comply with FERPA can lose federal funding. Many school districts intentionally keep records related to a student's gender identity in a separate system precisely to prevent parents from accessing them. This practice has led the Education Department to launch investigations and refer enforcement actions to the Justice Department. Parents seeking their children's educational records should therefore clearly state that the request is being made under FERPA, and they should specifically demand that all records related to gender identity be included. If the school denies any part of the request or is clearly withholding records, parents should file a formal complaint with the Education Department. Parents have the right to review curriculum under the protection of Pupil Rights Amendment. The PPRA, which became law in 1978, gives parents the right to inspect instructional materials used in connection with their child's education. Unlike a typical public records request, PPRA prohibits schools from imposing fees. The statute also generally prohibits schools from requiring students to answer surveys concerning highly personal subjects relating to the student or his family, including political beliefs, religious beliefs, mental or psychological issues, sexual behavior, finances, or other sensitive matters, without parental consent. America's First Legal has a PPRA toolkit with more information and a sample demand letter to schools to ensure that parents' rights under PPRA are respected. Title IX protects sex-separated spaces. This provision of the Education Amendment of 1972 prohibits discrimination on the basis of sex, and it applies to all schools that receive federal funds. The Constitution and federal statutes, bolstered by recent Supreme Court decisions and Trump administration regulations, guarantee that parents have the primary responsibility for directing their children's upbringing. But legal rights mean little if parents don't exercise them. You've been listening to a reading of articles and features from the August 27th issue of the Wall Street Journal. We read from the Wall Street Journal every Monday through Thursday at 11 p.m. Your reader has been Corrine. Thank you for listening.